Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Ray.
I'm Alex Reed.
Welcome back to another episode of...
Post-Limits.
Guys, welcome back to another episode of Mostly Lit. Alex has just stuck his middle finger at me because I've come for him once again.
I would never do such a thing.
Of course not. Thank you guys so much for listening. Unfortunately, we are still missing our third limb. I feel like we should shout him because we haven't been shouting him out.
Derek, where are you?
Where are you, Derek? Actually,
I feel like he's like living the life, you know, through the alchemist. You know, he's going to find that path.
Oh, God, find that thing.
And he's just, I could just picture Derek with like a long beard and like a staff on a mountain.
I can't imagine him that. His beard does not connect.
Wow, you're rude. But, you're very rude.
Whilst he's out there, we have another third limb joining us.
We have an amazing guest today, guys.
So really, really excited to introduce you to Gehinde Andrews, author of...
Back to Black.
Retelling Black Radicalism for the 21st Century.
Hey, back in the Andrews. Welcome, sir.
Hi, we're happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us, because I the first time I saw this book, right, someone in publishing received it, and I saw the cover, and I was like, this cover is amazing. Yeah. I don't know if, like...
It looks better than it is.
No, that's what I always say. Absolutely not.
It's beautiful, man.
When I got it, I was like, oh my God. So
it's hella black.
It just has, like, the black written in red.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's like matte black and the writing's like shiny. It's just a beautiful book to have.
It's a good book.
Obviously, read it.
We've seen quite a few people talking about it. I've seen on my social medias anyway. Mm-hmm. A few people mentioning it. I think I was watching somebody's story and they were reading out a passage of it. And I was like, I can't wait to get into this because the passage was quite spiky.
Okay.
So, we'll get into the book in a bit. But how was everybody's week? How's everybody doing?
My week has been very good, thank you. Mm-hmm. Have I done anything interesting this week? No. I don't think so. I've cleaned my house. Just done a bit of life admin. Oh, I did a interview with Stylist magazine.
Yes.
Talking about sleep.
Yeah, and about how she doesn't get any.
About how I don't get much sleep.
Yeah.
And how like insomniac I was.
Yeah.
I get like 4 hours, 58 minutes average currently. My body just wakes me up randomly. I cannot have a lie in. This morning I woke up at 5:30.
Oh, wow.
And I just lay in bed. So yeah, guys.
Yeah, a lion for me is 8 o'clock.
But a lion is like 8.
Yeah, a lion's 8 a.m.
That's not a lion. That's not,
and that's what I mean. Like, I wake up at the same time. Like, even today was like 7:45.
Really?
I woke up just naturally. Like, but I feel rested. It's like I'd probably be asleep by midnight.
What time? Oh, okay.
And then I'll be awake by 7:45.
Yeah.
I
just can't sleep.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's my week.
How about you? I'm good. I'm week number 4 of my barber leaving me out here looking like a crazy mess. So
yes. It's showing.
For people who haven't been following me on Instagram for a while, follow me. It's at Alex Reed_. I was just like, my barber going to call my barber, and I found out that he was just in Jamaica. Mm. Went there, like, he's gone there for 3 weeks and didn't even tell me. Like,
so you're actually not cheating on him because you kind of look rough.
Yeah, I'm actually rough, but like, you know when you're trying to like find your options and you're trying to find things? Now, I'm at the stage now where I'm like, should I just do it all myself?
And then I'm like,
I don't want to jack up my face.
Yeah.
Or my hairline. It's so I'd rather
you,
just not
it's
do
either
this.
You wait for him and be the loyal person that you are, that I know you are.
I'm not waiting for him. I'm vexed. How are you going to just leave me in the lurch, looking me crazy?
That's insane.
Leaving me crazy out here. Yeah, that's all I've been worrying about this week. Okay. The state of my hairline.
You made me sick. So, Kane, how has your week been?
I actually spent most of the week trying to get my 8-month-old son to sleep through the night.
Oh, wow.
So, talking about sleep.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
That's my fourth child.
Okay.
So, you don't say congratulations.
What do you mean? Child. Every child deserves that.
It's a blessing.
Yeah. Do you find that your kids like have had different personalities as children, as babies, or are they pretty much the same?
Yeah, no, I always thought it was nurture over nature. Yeah. But now I'm not sure because they're just different.
Like, yeah.
From birth, they're just different.
Yeah.
And you can see the personalities are really, really
Yeah.
How old's your eldest?
10 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
That's a good gap. 10 years before the youngest. Yeah.
10, 5, 3.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Good age gaps.
I want to have babies.
Do you?
Absolutely. I want to have babies that I can give away.
What?
when I'm a bit stressed, I'm like, okay, you have them.
We're going through very dangerous ground right now. How are you going to say I want children, but I want to give them away when I'm stressed? I don't understand.
Yeah, like, no, as in like temporarily, not like, you know, like, don't you get that sometimes?
Yeah, but grandparents are for it.
Give it to your parents and your aunties and uncles, godparents and all of that, like.
Madonna might turn up, she might.
Right?
Oh my God, come and take them.
She might take them, Angelina Jolie.
Do Instagram with them. Ew, it's a mess. Anyway, guys, what are we reading this week?
Oh, dun, dun, dun. Okay, guys, I'm so excited because I'm reading.
Oh God.
Matt Haig's How to Stop Time.
Yeah, I was meaning to get a copy of that.
It's so weird because I think Wednesday or whatever, I walked into my Waterstones at work, near work, and I was like, okay, I need a book. And I literally was like, I need a book that hasn't been recommended to me, because every time a book is recommended or there's hype about it, I always feel like I have this expectation. So I walked into Waterstones and I'm like, I'm going to get anything that catches my eye. And so I walked in and I was just, you know, scrolling. And this book wasn't even like on display in a particular place. It was like shelved with other books. So I'm so sorry, Matt Haig, your team needs to really step up.
It's been out for a while, though.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I literally was like, I just need a book. Like, I don't know who, I literally have not read any Matt Haig. Don't know who the guy is, literally.
Okay.
And so I was like, I just need something new, different. And I picked this up. I read the blurb. It's about a guy who ages very, very, very slowly. I think he's like 400 and something, 500 something years old.
Oh, amazing.
And he ages really slowly. And the thing at the back says, you know, you can stay alive, da-da, just make sure you don't fall in love. And I was like, oh, I have to get this book. And so I'm reading it right now, and it's the most, I don't know if I can describe a book as adorable. The book is adorable. It just has so much.
It's
just so.
Colour.
Yeah, and it's so adorable. I see it as like, if a book can be a 6-year-old cherub, this little baby. But it's about a 400-500-year-old man on his quest back to find his daughter, and he's taken up a new identity of being
a trying to find his
teacher.
Daughter at 500.
No, but his daughter has also got the ailment as well.
Oh, the ailment.
We're going to call it the ailment.
Okay.
And there's a particular word that they're called. I forgot the particular name, but we're going to call it an ailment.
That sounds good. Well, to be honest.
Yeah, and so she's alive, and he's like moved back, and he's a history teacher, taken up, and he's trying
to
teach.
That's kind of cheating, isn't it?
Trying to tell, trying to teach history by actually like literally having lived through it. And it's just wonderful. So yeah, I would really recommend it, guys. Matt Haig's How to Stop Time.
Can you imagine teaching about the Civil War? And you'd be like, well, back in that day. and they're like, what was it like? No.
And also, this is the first book that I've read post reading drought, because you guys know I'm having my reading drought and I've been finding it very, very difficult to read. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to finish this one.
Okay.
I know.
Well, that's growth.
I know.
Process and progress.
Big one. So I hopefully I finish it.
Cool. I'm reading 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. I've not actually started reading it yet, but it's put it in my bag with the intention to read it on my commute.
Yeah.
So he's the founder of PayPal. And it's just a book on startups and how to kind of like start building those kind of companies for the future and various different.
Why did you pick this specific one up? Because normally it's you're a self-help guy.
I'm a productivity kind of person.
Yeah, all of that.
And this is the kind of thing. But I was looking at this and I figured I do want to get a bit more of an idea of like the world of business, but then also want to see the context within like, you know, our kind of age. Like the Twitters and the Facebooks and all those kind of, and PayPals. And I just thought, like, oh, this is interesting. Peter Thiel's in the same kind of realm as Elon Musk. And I just wanted to, like, know what he's saying, really. Yeah. And, you know, like, you can never know too much, I guess. So it looks really interesting. 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel.
It's a
very orange book.
Bright orange book, but it's got a lot going on, like, up front.
It's like 0 to 1.
To one. And then there's all this
notes on startups.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's amazing. But it looks good. And I feel like there are little things, little nuggets in there. Just about enterprising and various different bits.
Fabulous.
Can't wait to get stuck into that.
Thank God. All right, Kende, what are you reading?
It's going to sound really cliched, but I actually am reading The Final Speeches of Malcolm X.
Oh,
that's awesome.
I mean, but I talk about Malcolm X all the time. but I'm writing a paper about Malcolm X as a social theorist.
Yeah.
So I have to read a lot more about Malcolm X. See, I only, because now when you're an academic, you basically read for work.
Yeah.
So every book's related to some piece of writing. Or
we're going to get into that.
Reading for your job.
Reading for your job. Not reading for your job, but what's it like being an academic? But yeah,
I think I was meant to be an academic.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool. not too late.
Not too late.
I know.
Not too late.
But they don't pay you guys.
No, we get paid our case, all right.
the last speeches.
Yeah, so it was the last speeches, the last from 1965.
Oh, okay.
How are you finding them?
I've read it before, to be honest, so I'm kind of going back. Because Malcolm, there's this kind of argument that Malcolm changes a lot after he leaves the nation. I don't think it's true, actually. I think he evolves. And you can see speeches in the 60s, 50s, they kind of have the same themes. So that's kind of what I'm saying in this paper, is that there's a kind of social theory in Malcolm X that we can trace back. So that's
it. Oh, okay. Cool.
Which you can see in the book, actually, Back to Black is sort of a lot of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's more specifically
a lot of a lot of Malcolm in here.
There's loads of Malcolm in here.
When I did the when I had the Word document, there were 246 pages, and I did like a search for Malcolm, and it was 236 times.
Oh my God.
It came up in the book.
Oh, it should have been called Back to Malcolm.
The retelling of Malcolm's radicalism. No, that'd be jokes. But yeah, okay.
All right.
We'll get into that in a bit. So who's lit this week?
This week, guys, who's lit is Galdem. As you guys know, this amazing publication, they have taken over the Guardian weekend this weekend. And the issue is written by all women of colour and non-binary people of colour.
Mm-hmm.
So a massive shout out to Liv Little, Charlie Cuff, on something.
And the team.
Yeah, and the whole team for doing something so amazing. Literally this morning, like obviously we record on a Saturday, so came out this morning. Yeah. And I literally like before coming here, picked it up. And I'm really, really looking forward to getting stuck in it.
Yeah.
Michaela Cole's on the front cover, looking all beautiful, glamorous.
So many black women on front covers in these next few months. Like it's just
been, this morning, actually, on
it's amazing stuff.
BBC Breakfast, they had I think is it Karen Hunt? She's basically one of the fashion editors on Elle UK, and she was having a conversation about how black women are. There was this idea that having a black woman on front covers won't be able to sell issues. But then currently, you know, the September issue is in fashion for fashion publications. It's like this amazing big thing that everyone looks forward to. And we've had a lot of covers, Vogue UK, Vogue US, Elle magazine, Porter, which has the amazing Lupita, soul sister. And, so it's quite amazing that black women are in these things. But my only concern is it that they're going to put them on one issue on September and then forget about them all the other times?
Yeah.
And how many times do black women come up within the issue in itself? So tokenistic, I think so.
Yeah. My thing is, I don't want it to just be a season. Like everybody's like, so we've got the Slaney Lane's book, we've got Chidi's book, What a Time to Be Alone and all these things. And you've got all these books out that are doing amazingly well and they're doing fantastic and people are writing things and getting themselves put out there on these pages. I just hope it's not just for a season. I hope that if somebody decides to write something like that in the next 2 to 5 years, that it will still get the same kind of...
Yeah, I think, you know? the Black British Renaissance is very much combusting right now. It's very much like it was happening, and it had a track, so it was people working, and now we see the fruits of their labor and how much work they've put in. I just hope that the smoke doesn't settle and we don't get nothing else.
Yeah.
But I guess the only way that happens if we continue talking about it and we continue doing the work, not just like, oh, you know what? They've done it. They've got one book out. Let me just chill and relax. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Hmm. Let's hope it.
We'll see. But anyway, there's everybody in that list is lit, and
congratulations. And we hope to see much more from you guys, and we can't wait to read.
Yeah. Amazing. So this week, we have, as you said, we've got Kayden Andrews here. We're going to be talking about his book, Back to Black. And first question I really wanted to ask was, what's it like being a Black academic in the UK? Because I know that we see a lot of these things. I know. We see a lot of these contexts in the US. And now we've got all these Black academics that have written so many books on Blackness and the system and all these things. We have very few, and we've had very few throughout history, like within the UK scene. We've had the prominent ones, the Podmore and Stuart Hall and various people. But what's it like being a Black academic now?
It's there's not that many of us. So I think 1% of all academics are Black.
Yeah.
Oh God.
And the higher you go up, there's less and less. So out of 18,000 professors, full professors, there's about less than 100 who are Black. So typically you're by yourself. You're not in a department with any other Black people. But we're a different entity. So at Birmingham City University, sociology and criminology, we have seven Black full-time members of staff.
Wow. That's amazing.
Which literally is probably more than every other university for about 100-mile radius put together. It's a bit different in that sense.
You're the first, I guess, UK professor who's teaching Black studies.
So I'm not actually a professor, but everybody calls me a professor, so I just go here, whatever. Black studies, the first Black studies degree course in Europe.
How did you manage? I mean, did you put a proposal out for that, or was it something that people in the sort of academic institutions told for you to, hey, would you mind doing this?
No, that would never happen.
Jeez, exactly.
No. So I got the job at Birmingham City University like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was me and Dion Taylor, who's still there, were the only Black staff. They put me in a senior position and they started giving us jobs. And we just said, well, let's get Black staff, let's do Black studies as research. And then over a few years, we ended up with, we think we recruited 3 Black women in a row, actually, which again, unprecedented, and wasn't as easy. Wasn't easy at all, but it managed to get there anyway.
Yeah.
And then, so basically when we did a lot of Black studies research, Black studies international stuff. And then we had all the staff that no one else has. So I just went to the university and said, let's do Black studies. No one else can do it. So it's an opportunity. And the university said, So it was actually way harder than it sounds.
Yeah.
But that was basically
that's like the footnote version. within a Black studies course. So I was talking about this with one of my friends about, in the States, they've got diaspora studies. Mm-hmm. Not diaspora studies, really. They've got things like African American studies, Africana studies, and whatnot. When Black studies in the UK, what are we looking at? What kind of content are we?
Yeah, so it's broad. So one, I think, is, and as you see in the book, the Blackness is, it's not like, it's not Black British, and it's not history. So those are the two things that commonly get confused.
Yeah,
there's a lot of history in the course, obviously, but it's more about kind of how do you understand the experiences, contributions, and perspectives of Africa and the African diaspora. So some of that's in Britain, some of that's in the Caribbean, some of that's in Africa, some of that's in America. So it's quite a broad scope in that sense. Probably more like diaspora studies. And then we do Black feminism. It's a huge strand and one of the specialisms in research. Politics.
I want to take this course.
In fact, Black feminism is, in terms of Black studies, is probably the most developed part of Black studies.
Is it focused on, like, for example, when I read Patricia Hill Collins' Black Feminist Thought, what I found quite annoying about, I mean, I think it's an amazing body of work, but it had such a focus on the African American female experience that I didn't feel that I was represented at all.
Really?
I saw some things, but it was so, because I feel like the particular African American experience dealing with the slave trade and coming out of that is so particular that as an African diasporic woman coming from East Africa to Britain, I didn't know how. I just thought there was a gap there that I spoke about when I told you I read it. Yeah. There was a definite gap there that I felt, that I'm like, what black woman can do the black British female experience? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think even to be fair, even for in Britain and black academia in Britain has been largely Caribbean based, so the slavery narrative is still there.
Yeah,
and so it probably ties more into like the American stuff.
Yeah,
but that's changing. I mean, that's changing as well. I think, especially when you've got people who are born here, and you, like you said, you've got people from Africa.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's developing, I think, and it's changing. But I also think that the American stuff is good for some things. So yeah. I actually think black feminist thought as an idea is really powerful. Actually, Patricia Collins came and keynoted one of our conferences.
Yeah.
We work with her quite a bit. So yeah, I see your point.
She's amazing.
And I think it's definitely changing and developing, I think, then.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, so I'm not going to touch on Beyonce now. However, in the beginning of this, you talked about how... You talked about black nationalism and how that's very different to black radicalism.
Yeah.
And it almost sounded like black nationalism was a safer option in my head.
Safer, like, what do you mean?
Like, you can get a bunch of black people talking about how proud they are of being black, but it's still within the social constructs, within the idea of, you mentioned, a nation within a nation.
Mm-hmm.
So us as black people, we can be proud, we can write all of these books, but if it's not changing the cultural and the political and economic climate of the nation, you're not doing much. So I'm thinking, and that's a sense of safer option of being black or being trying to be radical. And you mentioned the idea of, So in that sense, you kind of said taking yourself away from this racist country or whatever place that you're in and setting up, you know, whether it's Nation of Islam saying we want a different home somewhere else, we want a plot of land, and all of these different factions of people championing being separate. And you were like, in the end, you were like, well, that's not going to work. And I completely agree. However, at the near the end of the book, you talked about how sometimes separatedness isn't always a bad thing. So I'm like, how? So as in, I'm taking it in a, where is the middle ground?
Yeah, what are we supposed to do? That's basically how I ended up. That's where I ended up.
Yeah, because I was like, okay, on one end, I see it. On the other end, it's like, oh, okay. So I'm like, when I read that, I was like, okay, well, but in the beginning, so I'm like trying to be like, okay, like, tell me what it is that I'm supposed to do.
All right, the first of many, I'm sure, Malcolm X quotes. What does Malcolm say? He says, the word separation has been misused. It's really about independence. And that's the difference. So, it's not about saying we want to have a separate bit of land. So the Nation of Islam was like, let's have a separate bit of land to serve. Or even the Haitian Revolution, which I think I talk about in the book as well. It's a revolution, they revolt, they've got this own separate bit. But end of the day, if you're surrounded by capitalism in the West and that system that's oppressing you is still there, you can't really be separate.
Yeah.
And so what we're trying to say is that you need to have independence, which looks like separateness in some senses, because you are saying Pan-African Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. But it needs to be done in a way that really... I mean, the book ends on the line, I think, as we leave the house, we need to bring it crashing down.
Yeah.
Because the West is the problem. And as long as the West is there, it's always going to be the problem.
Yeah.
So it's about building it independent rather than separate.
Yeah.
So with regards to, like, having that independence, is it a matter of saying... I think touched on idea of keeping black wealth within... black communities, just as how other communities have done so. And so how exactly are you going to establish that whilst also crushing the system?
So this is the contradiction, and you picked it perfectly, right? It's actually, if you look at what the politics is, it says that we should organize, we should come together, we should pool our resources, right? That looks a lot
that's
like
Pan-Africanism, right?
That's Pan-Africanism, but it's also that's a big part of just black nationalism.
Definitely.
And you could definitely do that in a way that wouldn't help, that would make, you know, you could have like Italians in America did very, very well by pooling their resources, et cetera, et cetera. But America's still America.
Yeah.
that's not kind of not the point, right? The point is to say, well, how do we develop a different, independent system? And the only way to do that really is on the African continent, because the African continent has the resources, it has the tools, it has the... to actually be properly independent.
So it could do that, but my only concern is International investment in Africa is out of this world.
Oh, yeah,
China just goes in there, takes it apart, says we're gonna build a bridge, but you know there could be this much of corporate responsibility. We might give you jobs, but as soon as that bridge is done, we're out.
Yeah, and I feel like
you don't have jobs.
Yeah, and I feel like what you spoke about in the book as well is about when these countries needed that support or they didn't necessarily, it was still that crutch they had to. They were
Precisely.
Oh, it's like, you know, when you leave a. You know, when you go to university, right? And you're like, your parents have just left you, in the halls, and you're like, and then you're like, well, I have no food, and then it's like, hey, mom, can you transfer me some money? Can you wire me some? Yeah. And but like, obviously, like, in this context, it's like, well, we can wire you some, but there are going to need to be some concessions made,
Absolutely.
And you know, you need to liberalize your economy and do all these different things.
I love that you mentioned then how tutus, white devils,
yeah, the white devils, and then tutus, It was just like. All of these nations that are so-called independent now have a crutch,
absolutely,
and a huge economic debt riding on their backs. And you know, I worry when we say things like, you know, if we go back to the continent for us to have a truly independent economy and systems and whatnot, it's like looking into ourselves and kind of being able to do that, like. In each state,
This is the problem with the nation. The nation is the problem.
Yeah.
Right. So Ghana, Nigeria, Zimbabwe. These are made up by Europe. They literally made up. They sit down and draw out these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah,
those
yeah.
are the problem. That's the first crutch you have to get over. You say that there is no black is a country. The third chapter.
Yeah.
You say that we have to organize across Africa, across the diaspora.
Yeah.
And really do that. Once you do that, then you have your power base, and then you can organize something totally separate and independent, if you like. And that's the only way forward. I mean, that really is. For black radicalism, the only logical thing to do. It's not easy to do, but
it's definitely not easy, because I'm thinking about all the different ethnicities, cultural differentiations. I'm looking at the tribes and personalities of the different African identities.
Yeah, but when did the European Union come as an idea? After the Second World War. After then,
there are many identities and many cultures and many languages.
Yeah,
here we are. Trying to break it, and everybody's doing madness right now.
Actually, this is what Europeans or white people do, but we don't think long term.
Yeah.
Like 50 years is a long time. 50 years ago, the reason the book's called Back to Black is saying 50 years ago, this wouldn't have been this. Now, this sounds like a crazy fantasy. 50 mm-hmm. years ago, this is a real thing.
Yeah.
Like the Pan African Revolution was happening. There was capitalism might not have survived, and in the next 50 years, if we take a different route, we could be right back there again.
Yeah.
So that's what it's about.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so there's a particular line in the book that I was a bit intrigued with, and I wanted to question you on it. There was a point where you were talking about who can go about making this change. Paraphrasing, and you said that it in a way. Okay, paraphrasing as well. Actually, I can find it. Okay, and I was like, "Ooh, saucy!"
That's a good reaction.
This is what you came
you
to
said
do.
we are deluding ourselves if we. No, sorry. In reality, the black middle class possesses the skills necessary to succeed within Western imperialism, a system opposed to black freedom. We are deluding ourselves if we are looking for the house Negro to solve the problems of the plantation.
Shaking in water.
Honestly,
I was like, what is happening here?
I was like,
this is interesting. I think, and then as further down the passage, you talk about Uncle Tom and stuff like that. And I was just right in the corner, wrote Django. That's what I was right in the corner. Because I was like, interesting point.
So,
but yeah, let's unpack that then.
Yeah. So basically, like I class myself as working class, although apparently people. Derek thinks that once you've got a nice job, you're all of a sudden middle class.
It's different because culturally working class and there's economically.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know.
And so, and I know I have middle class friends, blah, 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 who are equally as abhorred by the state of the black identity currently. And so when you said that, are you meaning it in a sort of, well, these people enjoy the luxuries of whiteness and being able to move freely into and out of it. And so they can't possibly make any sort of difference. Or,
I mean,
Or or it's like, so that's like actual, like, is it that they, like, if you think you're middle class, you really cannot fight this battle.
Yeah.
However, or is it like a theoretical thing in your head whereby you have to have, if you have a certain mindset, then you can't make that difference. How did you mean that?
It's a bit of both, right? So in a sense, it's not saying that middle class, I'm more,
yeah, you
class
said that,
people, right?
Yeah.
It's not saying the middle class aren't part of the struggle at all. In fact, if you listen to Malcolm X again, House Negro, Field Negro, he's not saying the House Negro isn't part of the struggle. In fact, his argument is the House Negro is just as oppressed as the Field Negro. I'm just as oppressed as the man named on road, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's understanding that, firstly, and then making sure that we orient our politics to the least of us, the least of us. But the point is saying that from my position, and it's ironic given that I wrote this book, right? But the middle class don't get it, can't get it. Materially don't understand because we are too comfortable within the house. And the only thing that separates this book out, really, is I would say this is, it's not my view. This is the view of a black radical tradition that spans centuries.
I found it interesting that you were like, that obviously not you, but Malcolm X was basically saying, you know, the, and he made the comparison, but he's like, the Field Negro is more authentically black. And the working class, and they're like, the working class black is more authentically black.
I don't know,
black.
I have a real
so
problem
I was
with
just
that.
Like, where, what's happening here?
No, I have a real problem with that
because I get it.
Yeah.
I get it, what you mean. Yeah,
no, I get it as well. However, I think that what it tries to do is it tries to write down certain parameters of what it is to be black. And are we, if, I don't know, I think it might be a bit problematic if we then say that blackness pertains only to the working class. And if we're looking at the work, if we look at the traits of the working class, we say, well, poor, you know, they're in poverty, they don't have certain jobs, they might have not have a certain education. And my only problem is, if we align blackness with those types of adjectives and ways of being, how can we progress?
No, so I guess the point is that, because I think oftentimes when we say that Field Negro is more authentic, what that typically means is that we say that culturally, right? So like, poor black culture is black culture, and you see that all the time.
Actually,
I wrote a whole paper about this, about hip hop. Yeah. Yeah, 100% what I'm not saying, actually, because culture, you can have poor black people who are just as much House Negroes. So for example, gangster rap, that's House Negro, that's Uncle Tom, that's the same Uncle Tom in the way that the banker is, if you like.
Right? Yeah, actually, let me actually find that passage. I'm coming back.
But what is being said is that, and I think this is important, I think this is where the Field Negro is important, is that to be black is to be oppressed. And it's when you're in my position, it's very easy to forget that. But when you're poor, but you can't really forget it, right? Yeah, because you understand it and you experience it. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, I get that. Alex has a
pass. It's just funny because I read it. It's like, it is easy to point out the well-educated, middle-class, government-appointed Uncle Toms, like Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas in America, or former head of the Commission for Racial Equality Trevor Phillips in Britain. So I was like, okay.
Yeah. Formerly, like, of the black community, yeah, Trevor Phillips.
Formerly of the black community. And then he was like, but we miss the point. We miss the point if we conflate Tomming with the culture of the middle class. A good example of the modern-day Uncle Tom would be a rapper like Lil Wayne, who clothes himself in the culture of street to appeal to the masses, but writes lyrics such as "I whip it like a slave." I was just like, you know when you read something, and you're just like, wow, and it's just like the impact of culture around you, because you're not really. Not everybody's looking at it like that. Do you see what I mean? It's just, this is just music. Like, I'm going to just get into it. Yeah, Lil Wayne said this, Lil Wayne said that. But when you mentioned Lil Wayne in there, I was like, right, so how many other rappers out there are just donning the culture and then just putting out lyrics that are just, you know?
Unfortunately, the majority of people, that's what it is, really.
Yeah.
That's what it's become anyway. It didn't used to be that, but that is where it is.
Man, I find that super interesting.
So, I feel like I'm interrogating you today.
That's good.
Well, you said that you've had really nice interviews, right?
Yeah, they were too nice.
No one's,
nice.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so let's go. Right, so there was a particular part when, so you'd wear, let's just get back to the whole black nationalism part. There was a part that I found really interesting where you mentioned how some people think to be a radical, I guess, paraphrasing, of course, is to just go about supporting any sort of black business. And you talked about the banality of that idea of black nationalism. Even if these so-called people go against your politics, you just support them and you think all of a sudden you're a radical. So I've been doing this. And I'm gonna confess, I have. Like, a lot of the times I'll support someone and support their business, even, you know, it's not great. But I'll be like, you know what? They're a black sister, they're trying, they're a fellow black brother, they're really out here, let me support. And I thought I was doing like, oh, okay, I think that's all right. But clearly, Kenny,
we ain't supposed to be doing that.
I read that and I was like, hold up a minute. So how do you go about, so for example, you mentioned how the only possible solution or possible way in which to be a black radical and to actively work within it is to go to Africa with its all its resources and all the land and for us to be truly, truly independent as a black nation.
Eventually.
However, we're not there yet. So what can we do as young black people in 21st century Britain, not only to get there, because by the grace of God, inshallah, we will get there. but what do we do in our day-to-day lives if not to support blindly?
Well, no, it's not support. It's not to support blindly. That's the key. So a lot of this book comes out of practice. And that whole point of the book is also practical.
Yeah.
To say that we have this organization which mirrors Malcolm X's organization of Afro-American Unity called the Harambee Organization of Black Unity.
Yeah.
And when we started it, we were on the black business thing. And we did this publication and we had a business directory where all the black businesses, put the black businesses in there, support the businesses. Did it free for like 3 editions, I think it was. And then we went back and said, well, can you pay? Because, you know, we're kind of, this is costing us a lot of money, etc. And I think about 2 of them did have about 120 or something.
Shut up.
Loads of businesses. And that's where I learned straight away. Those 118 businesses, you don't support. Why would you support them? If they won't support the organization, you shouldn't support them just because they're black. But there is a way to do it where you bring along the businesses that want to support you, that will put the money into it. And that's how you go forward. Blindly supporting. A black capitalist is a capitalist. It doesn't really matter. They don't change it. They're not going to make the world any better.
Yeah.
So I think it's about how do we build a movement that, yeah, supports business, because obviously we have to get jobs and we live here and we're not going to Africa anytime soon. But has the politics that can take us there eventually.
Is it that we're kind of like looking at capitalism from like in a really strange way? Like, you know, if you have the money, support the cause. You know what I mean? Like, if you have those, you put your publications, for example, if it's a good publication, support it. It shouldn't be too far out of your remit to be like, well, I'm going to just produce it because I like the content, I like the quality. Do you see what I mean? So where does this thing go about, oh, well, they're just a capitalist and they're not going to, why do we not part with the money? Like, I don't understand. Why don't we part with it?
I mean, the business thing is just another, is a different example of, just because someone's black, should we support them? There's loads of people who are black you shouldn't support. Bill Cosby. Why would you support Bill Cosby?
Yeah.
I mean, those, it's a bit R. Kelly. I don't know. Like, there's loads of people, right? But we still end up supporting them because they're black, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same with the businesses. If there are businesses that want to support the community, you should support their business. Mm-hmm. If not, go and spend your money, and you may as well spend your money in Tesco because it don't make no difference.
This is true. This is true.
Wait, isn't that the... Isn't that
every little help?
But I kind of wanted to ask you like about Pan-Africanism. I feel like I went for a stage in second year.
I don't know why you and Derek went for a Pan-African stage. I never did.
I don't even know if this was Pan-Africanist. Yeah, but obviously I grew my hair out. I was doing the Afro pick. I was doing like reading up on all these black
scholars. This is what happens when you're not
scholars.
Born in Africa.
Yeah, this is what happens.
Because I didn't.
You had a crisis of confidence. But then, you know. But then, obviously, Jamaican. I was thinking about going Rasta and doing all madness. But Pan-Africanism, I think that I kind of didn't... I don't think I understood fully what it was. And at this point, I'm a bit clearer on the idea now, because at first I thought, oh, Pan-Africanism, that means you're excluding the Caribbean. Like, and obviously then I was reading up on Pan-Caribbeanism and then that whole thing, and then that was confusing, so I was like, you know what, let me just not even do this, because I don't know what I'm doing, I don't know what I'm talking about. But do you want to try and explain to people, kind of, because there might be people that are listening that don't necessarily know what it is. They hear it, they have a particular idea of what Pan-Africanism is, and obviously, and that's typically Hotepery that comes next to it, and you know what I mean,
like,
and you know what I mean. But like reading your book and then reading about Pan-Africanism and reading about like the where it didn't work, where it does work, where all these things, would you shed some light on it?
Yeah, for so the actually, people. The Pan-Africanism chapter was the most difficult to write, actually, because I kind of had a more rose-tinted view of Pan-Africanism, and if you grow up here, that's kind of Pan-Africanism. That's radical. That's what it is. But the history is a lot more complicated. Yeah. I'll be positive about it. Generally, basically, what the idea is that you have a unification of Africa across the continent. It's revolutionary Pan-Africanism is you take down the borders. You have essentially a United States of Africa that plans the economy and supports each other. But also, really importantly, supports the diaspora as well. Mm. So if you think about someone like Marcus Garvey, who you were talking about my critique of Jamaica earlier. Okay. Jamaica's national hero basically says, Jamaica can't work, take everybody out of Jamaica and take them back to Africa, right? Because that's how you solve the problem of racism here, is by solving the problem of Africa. So the two are connected.
Yeah.
The diaspora is connected to the continent.
Yeah.
I'm 110% for it.
Really?
Thank you. Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine a borderless Africa?
No. I actually can't imagine that. When that happens, though.
Yeah, I think like, it will be... It's so weird because I remember specifically we had Nancy on. We had a young woman on the show and she said it is harder to fly within Africa.
Oh, yeah, I remember that episode. Yeah.
Harder to do that than it is to jump and go internationally.
Actually, it's the same with the Caribbean as well. Actually, and I think, the airways is hard. Like they're like literally miles apart.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to fly out of Africa to get back into Africa. And I'm like, that's mind-boggling.
The airways.
It's absolutely...
But that's neocolonialism. The whole infrastructure is set up to benefit...
Precisely.
Not to benefit us, right?
Yeah.
And so the one thing that would benefit us is unity across the continent. Mm. The infrastructure is like the complete opposite for that to exist.
Yeah.
But then it's like, my only concern is, if we are trying to get this to happen, just speaking practically, we just talk about how African leaders are corrupt. Mm-hmm. And how they get into the system designed to replicate the so-called democracy of the Western states. And they rise up the ranks and they don't do anything, essentially. Nope. So us as laymen politically, we can talk about it.
Mm.
But I don't want to seem so defeatist, but it seems like the people who need to make this change are more concerned with ensuring that the gold or silver or copper and tea in their countries goes elsewhere. Let's build a bridge here and look after the roads to placate the commoners and the people that live here. But essentially, it's all propped up to ensure that Western investments thrive rather than internal domestic consumer stuff. So I'm like, I don't know, how do you go about making that change?
Well, that's the point of radicalism. Is radicalism, you reject the roots of a society. Why on earth would we look for the solution in the political system which was put together by Western imperialism? That whole system is a joke. Forget that. We need to do something else. Do something different. And what that is.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is build an organization that doesn't have national boundaries, that has one in Birmingham, there's one in Kinshasa, there's one in there's one in Lagos that has a proper international, that has the grassroots, because it, and if we talk about Africa, and we talk, we're always talking about the elite, very rarely talking about the masses of people who basically have no voice.
Yeah.
So build an organization that's full of those people, and then you just overturn the state. The state's the problem. So you want to work with the
I get that, but then how would you get the funding? Because we can have groups and meet up and have all these talks and do a few protests, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, and I get it, the more people we have, the stronger we will be.
Yeah. That's it. It's a mass mobilization. But that is where the West is important. Because actually we do have access to full money here. Actually, we do have wealth here.
Mm.
If you could politicize that wealth and radicalize that wealth, if you like, then that's where you get your money to support
the movement. To do the thing.
In fact, I would say what we would do is if all of us took out as much loans as we possibly could, I'd probably get about £200,000 loan tomorrow.
Yeah.
Take it out of the bank and leave. God, we all go together.
Yeah.
We funded the whole revolution.
That's actually bangs. Yo, you're up to something.
That's actually true.
I mean, we're not telling you, but can you imagine
but
if
what
we
about
did that?
My job and my bills though, I got to pay?
But well, you know, we can find you a place to live.
Yeah, I'm double glazing my house.
Right?
Yeah, that's the problem.
But yeah, that is the problem.
We're all too eating.
I'm thinking about my house plant. I have my deposit. Yeah. Am I going to get that back?
But that's a really good thing, because that was a very good piece on the independence notion. Because when I was having this thought about the Caribbean and its and the independent states that are there, and how they actually are just like still homages to colonialism and imperialism, and literally nothing is necessarily changing. Yes, they no longer have, but the Queen is still the head of state. And you just look at it and you think, How are none of them republics? And why is there none of that? Why is there none of that thought to make them republics? Because why should there be a royal family that doesn't even look like they're from the country? There are white Jamaicans. There are Indian Jamaicans. There are various different colours.
There shouldn't even be royal families.
But then, at the same time,
yeah, royal families don't make sense.
Does the Queen even go to
my
Jamaica?
Issue is, so we talk about all this, we talk about all this black achievement that has been happening recently in Britain.
Yeah.
And after having this conversation, a part of me feels like it's all redundant because obviously I'm very proud and I really wish that a lot of more black people can continue doing what they're doing. They're thriving.
Mm.
But I'm like, 1 minute, hold on. If it's all within this structure and nothing, it's just give us the limelight for a bit. Let me talk to you about my issues. Let me talk to you how oppressed I am. Let's have this podcast talking about how oppressed black people are. But we're going to put it on SoundCloud and hopefully you might get a sponsor and get a few retweets. Oh, look, most of it, let's do something with I don't know, the BBC. Let's do something bigger.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're like, oh my God, yes, because now we're getting recognized. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It just seems like it's all very redundant.
Because even recent successes of various things across social media and whatnot, I've seen, and it's like, after reading the book, I'm like, is that a success then?
Precisely.
Because, you know what I mean? Like, it's like you're...
This conversation made me so depressed. We haven't done nothing.
Like, you know what? It didn't make me depressed. It made me feel like, wow, I was actually walking around with blinkers on. Like, you know when you think to yourself, right, I'm an educated person. I've got my degree. I've got my this, that, I'm walking around. I've read quite a few things. I get it. And then it's just like something comes out of the way and like knocks you off the donkey that you think you're riding, and you're like, wow, that's very interesting.
I'm feeling very radical at the moment.
And the point is not to say these are bad things, but we have more opportunity now in many ways and more platforms to do different things. So like, you use that platform to do something different.
But like, the question is like, just think about these things, because the stuff that we kind of get shown, and like, you know, a lot of people aspire to certain certain institutions to be higher in certain places. They're like, oh my gosh, yeah, you made it. Well done. Yes. Clap, click, do all these things. And you just look at it now, and looking at it now, I'm like, is it a success?
It's not their platform.
I don't think so.
Because
they're
not making money on it.
What are you doing? But anyway, so that was kind of an interesting aspect that came out of the book. Guys, get this book. I swear to God, you will literally just look at things completely differently. And it will actually just make you start thinking critically. You know what I mean?
I have an article that I wanted to write and I wanted this publication to get it. And I'm like, you know what? Like, what's the point?
No, because
you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm just like, really? what can you do for me?
No, because
you're just oppressing my people.
But you have to use the power that you have, right?
How
do people even know about this book? One, I'm an academic, so that gives me credibility. Mm. Two, I've been on the BBC and write for The Guardian, so that gives me a platform. Without those platforms, no one reads the book.
You have to create
the platforms that you have.
You have to create those spaces and
the white spaces
and do what you got to do.
Yeah.
But what I found also interesting was your chapter on blackness. And
you started that chapter cussing.
I texted Ray. I was like, Ray, chapter 5, upside down smiley face. And she was like,
It's edited.
So basically, just to get it out of the way. Okay, we're gonna have a little small moment on it, and then we're gonna move on because this is a very important academic talk we're having here. We're not gonna spend it on the beehive.
We know where we're going, guys.
Precisely. So, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I totally understand.
What was actually said, first of all?
Yeah. Oh, so basically. Beyonce's Super Bowl moment that she had, people were hailing it, and it, I saw it on my timeline on Twitter that it was such a radical movement, revolutionary. She mentioned the Black Panthers, there was mention of it, and she alluded to the Jackson 5, and it was just out of this world amazing, and she's finally using her her platform to talk about black issues. And then Kehinde Andrews was like, actually,
first of all, what you ain't gonna do is you ain't gonna misappropriate the words.
Yeah,
that's what you know.
And I remember the part when he wrote. I'm gonna say he because right now I'm just really angry with him.
Just give it 5 minutes.
He wrote, "More power, brackets, not black power." To her, I was like, "Wait, what? How dare you?" So essentially, I get it. Beyonce. It's when we talk about black power and black radicalism, to do stuff like that on a public platform that, as you said, has already been given consent of all of these white organizations. Yeah. It's almost lukewarm. It's not even, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
However,
Ray met a very weird duality right now because she was at one point she was like, "Am I going to stand or am I going to look at it?"
Yeah, no,
rationally,
I'm looking at it rationally and I'm like, it makes sense.
Yeah.
However, if somebody can look at that, if police can get angry about what she said, if some far right people can get a bit perturbed in their spirit, then
it's basically prodding.
It's not radical. That I totally understand.
All I'm really saying is not radical.
Yeah, it's not radical.
It's not necessarily bad. It's not
radical. I mean, you didn't even say it was great. Like, it was a great performance. But
it was a very good performance.
It was a
very good
performance. What do you expect? I don't know. I almost didn't do it because I got about three, four days of having to turn notifications off on my phone.
Yeah, because you wrote something for
The Independent.
And they put this crazy headline on there, which wasn't really what I meant at all. And that's
obviously it's clickbait.
Yeah, I mean, it is like a black man saying this about a black woman at a time when she's done something. So I can understand why.
Yeah, kind of went
I probably was someone that probably came for you. It might be. I could have been.
It wasn't me. It was a passing. I don't know her.
So this is the more more explained version of it. And like I said, I wasn't upset with Beyonce. I was upset with everybody else.
Reactions and how they... Yeah.
That's what... I watched that live and didn't have any reactions. Like, okay, it's Beyonce. It's good. It's what you expect.
And then you went online and you saw all of
For days and days.
Yeah.
And that's that misrepresentation of radicalism, which I think is dangerous because we need the radical analysis.
Yeah, I think radicalism right now is romanticized in a way. It's like, I'm a black radical. Let me wear my hair in an afro. Let me wear black. Do you know what I mean? It's very romanticized. And it's almost now propped up to sell as well.
Yeah.
Something that can, it's like anything. Oh, so if capitalism, really annoys me because it can take absolutely anything and just package it up nicely and sell it to you. And it does this with feminism, which I hate, especially when I see t-shirts and stuff and people are buying all these things and it's just like, I'm a feminist. And I'm like, I get it, but do you know what you're doing? You're giving that to Topshop.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think that it's just more interrogation. It's more knowing where we are getting the the clothes from. Like, for example, there's a clothing line called Sassy Apparel, which is really good.
Yeah.
And, like, they create, like, really amazing, like, slogans on their T-shirts. You know, the really amazingly black slogans on their T-shirts. But you know where the money is going to.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, it's a grassroots business company, a black company.
It's still capitalism.
It's still capitalism, but I'm saying that you interrogate where it's going to. Do you see what I mean? Like, if it's going to Topshop, you're thinking, as you said, like, the money's going, it's just kind of, like, disappearing into HQ, and I don't know where it's been distributed. But you know that if it's a grassroots, like, black-owned business, I feel like, you know, there's and it's a good quality, then you can then you'd be like, well, I want to wear it because I know where I got it from. My ethics are still intact, and so is my, like, integrity.
I just have a problem. I mean? But I have one question for you, Kehinde. Can you be a black radical and be in an interracial relationship?
Do you know what? The timeline...
Because there was this conversation happening.
Twitter has... I'm not on Twitter at the minute, but I see things.
There was people. This... I think there's... Oh, what's it called again?
Oh, no, there's a show called The Grapevine. Have you heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
And it came to the UK, and it had a few UK hosts, panelists on there.
Yeah.
And
so there was the conversation.
This is the conversation. The conversation was, can you be pro-black and be in an interracial relationship?
But I guess for you, like, when I was reading this book, I was thinking about it, and I was like, well, can you be a black radical and be in an interracial relationship?
Well, I mean, I think a key part of the book is to say that black radicalism, you can get into black radicalism at any point, and you may well have a white partner, and if you want, that doesn't stop you getting into black radicalism. I guess that's a kind of a fudge answer. But I mean, I think what I'd say is, I was somebody who once gave a talk at university called Why I Would Never Marry a White Woman, right? So that gives you my whole history background. But I think that if we're building a black organization and we're doing the work, it's not that you just, I just don't think you would. Not necessarily that it's banned. I just think the logic of it is that you'd probably
wouldn't go do it.
Wouldn't really be a debate.
But does it matter?
But
do you think, I mean, if you're doing the work offline, if you're doing the work and you're, it depends on how you.
So somebody technically, it's like, it's almost one. There's this aspect of, I guess, self-hate, but at the same time, it's almost hypocritical because. These are this person's words. Like, you're talking about blackness, you're kind of overcompensating for the fact that you've got this white partner who you share a bed, a life, a love and family and happiness with, and they probably have a different, very different culture to you. It's basically getting into bed with the oppressor in a certain way, right?
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
I mean, that's what it looks like on the surface.
That's what it looks like, right?
But love is love. We are 2018.
Right, but love is love. Exactly, love is love. And a part of me feels like the power of love is transformative, I think, anyway.
Okay, I'll ask you a question. Could I write this book and have a white wife?
Do you have a white wife?
Did he not just give a talk and I said, never is a long time.
He might be hiding another white wife. We don't know about this.
Well, but could you write this book and be married to a white woman?
I think you could.
Do you know what I think? I think in this day and age, it would actually belittle the book. Do you see what I mean? Like, I feel like, you know what I mean? Like, I would read it and be like, well, I'm reading it. Because, you know, some people won't necessarily read it in that way.
I'd be like, yes, you can. But if you're like, oh, but my wife is white.
What are you talking about, Ray? Well, of course, if you didn't know. Like, if you read it and then he told us today that he was married.
It would be a problem, right? Like,
if I said don't, yes, I don't know, like, you know.
It would shift my integrity.
But then what we are saying is that you cannot align yourself with black values, blackness. You cannot be full in support of blackness, understanding the whole history, if you go home and lay with somebody that possibly doesn't understand it as much. Because the learned experience of your white wife or what blackness is very different to the lived experience of a black woman who understands. So in that sense, it would be different. But at the same time, how important is it that you have someone who you share your life with that is black and for you to understand? Do you need that? I think that's the question.
The reason I made this argument about why I would never marry a white woman was to say that there is a difference between if you're leading an organization or if you want to start something. You can't have a white partner. Don't forget about it. Because I can't start an organization of black unity with a white partner.
But why? But is it that...
Because it doesn't make sense.
No, it's not even that it doesn't make sense. It's optics, I think. It's optics.
Is it?
Theoretically, inside, like your mind, your heart, your soul, I don't know if it doesn't make sense. However, optically, then you're like, well, what are you doing, my friend? You want to be about blackness, but you're in bed with someone that's not black. But I don't, I think it's all optics.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't think it's, I don't know. I just don't think it's...
Okay, one side of me saying it's not, it doesn't even matter. You're doing the work. He's making
you're doing the work. Who you love is who you love.
And you know what? If they get it, because you know what I mean? Like, sometimes if you're doing it and you're hiding your white partner,
then
I feel like sometimes it's a bit like, if they are doing the work, like, you know, do you, any of you watch Scandal? Not Scandal, sorry. How to Get Away with Murder. You know, Matt McGorry? Anyway,
he's
one of the
goofy guy.
The goofy guy. He's always like, on his Instagram and stuff, he's always like sharing books and he's talking about...
Is his babes black?
I don't know, actually. Okay. But
he's very woke.
But does that mean? But he's doing the work. He's trying to learn things. He's basically trying to deconstruct his own whiteness to figure out like what, like, you know what I mean? What the crap is as well.
Which I think you can do.
But that's what I'm saying. But like, there are several people who are like that. And if they're in those relationships, they will make that.
However,
we're in
a space now where like being black is hard right now.
It's always been
hard, but now it's like people are putting in the work. I think that in the future, when we are on a level playing field, then nobody will have an issue with that when inequality is scrapped or whatever, which I don't know if will happen anytime soon. However, I think the issue is now, because there is that imbalance, because we have that our history, which is so plunged in oppression, it can happen. I think, oh God, like, love is so transformative, it can totally change, but I don't think it should take away...
Can I just mention a quick story then? But like, you know, we've got the academics like Stuart Hall and then Padmore?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but they were both involved with white partners and whatnot. And I think when I found that out, I just felt a bit like...
You felt like that because
I'm just like, because I was just like, well, you know, I'm reading you guys, I'm learning from you guys, I'm figuring out my identity with you guys.
Why does that change? And then I'm like,
it depends on your own, like, my own upbringing and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I'm like, I'm in a black home, okay, so there's this black academic that gets it, and I want to see a black family with him. Then I'm like, but hold on.
But why?
Because it's the knowledge that he's giving you. Yeah.
Is that knowledge being tainted or diluted in a way? Because then I'm thinking, what is it now that is your view kind of tainted then?
Because that's the point, right? Yeah. Like, it's not a coincidence these academics tend to have white partners. Academia is white, so you spend a lot of time with white people.
Yeah.
Stuart Hall is a perfect example. So he did a lot of work in Birmingham, and there's a lot of like, oh, Birmingham and the grassroots and all that. My family's from Birmingham. He was not in the grassroots at all, right?
Yeah.
He didn't ever still know black people in Birmingham.
He came from an upper-class family in Jamaica. And he circulated
with white people. And that does actually change the politics. Whereas if I'm saying, look, if we're a black radical saying, look, it's grassroots. I work with black people all the time. I'm with black people all the time.
Mm.
I'm just going to have a black partner. It's not even a discussion. It's just because that's where I am. And if you're not there and you're somewhere else, can we really trust the analysis that you're giving us? I think that's the key word.
That's it. It kind of like, yeah. Because I feel like it does, it kind of, what's the word? Not the authenticity.
I don't like that word.
No, it's not the word. That's what I'm saying. It's not the word. Oh, I forgot what the word is. You know when you said, you're an academic, so this kind of gives it a stamp already. I forgot the actual word is, but it's that. Sorry. So.
Merit?
I don't know.
But I do want to say, you're not precluded. You can have a white partner and be a black radical. It's not impossible.
Yeah.
Would your white partner be willing to give it all up for Africa
and be part of the struggle?
Oh, it reminds me of that film that we watched.
Yeah, the United Kingdom.
Yeah, that film was cringe. Sorry. Yeah. it was a little cringe.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. There's a bit that you did touch on though in the book. It's about my uncle actually brought this up to me. I remember having this conversation with him. My family's from Leicester. We were there, and it was like, and he would say, "Oh, there's an aspect of being black called negrescence,"
mm-hmm.
and I was like, mind you, what's negrescence? And then he was just like, you know, when you discover that you're black, there's a process of you discovering your blackness as you grow older.
The way that it was described
in the book, there was like, when you learn that you're no longer a Negro, you are now a black person. Like this kind of thing, like, you know what I mean? But
did you ever have a moment where you realized that you're black?
Yeah.
What was your moment like?
I don't think it's ever one moment, but I think it was actually going to school, primary school. Like, yeah. When I think back on it, like these little things, like speaking patois at home and then calling things like a rag and all this stuff. And I'm just like,
flannel.
And flannel. And they're like, oh yeah, do you mean a flannel? I'm like, a rag? What? Like, these little things that you learn as you grow older, but like discovering your actual blackness, I think probably year 9, 10. And
you went to a white school, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
Really?
Yeah, but being in year 9, 10, I actually realised that, you know, my identity as a Jamaican, British-born Jamaican person and being part of the Caribbean and in that wider scope, so you're talking about the music that you all listen to, the food that you all eat and all of that, and then how that differed when I realised that, Deji was actually Nigerian. And I was like, wait a minute, so you're actually Nigerian? Tell me more. And I didn't realise that until I was year 12. I don't know why I was just kind of like, well, I wasn't really concerned with anybody else, but then I started to open up my eyes. I was like, oh, so we're black, but we're all from different places. Mm. I'm interested. Where's Sierra Leone? Where's Tanzania? Where's all these places? And that's when I started to discover that black is a country. Yeah. A nice little ending on my monologue.
It's so but different, yeah, because I've 15. Always been battling the idea of being a black African diasporan, all these words, because I wasn't born in this country, and so what you guys all I feel like have this black British thing going on, and you listen to certain music and your black is very much around being outsiders in Britain, I suppose. But when I moved here, like Zanzibar, like was home. I had not met a white person. I think there was one white person I met at the beach once. And so when I came here, I remember I was on the plane and this woman taught me how to eat spaghetti with a fork. Like in Zanzibar, use our hands. So I didn't know how to eat spaghetti. And I came here in January, so it was freezing and I was just wearing a jumper. And the air attendants, they gave me the blankets to come out with because they were like, yo, what are you doing? It's like freezing out here and you're here with a jumper. So they gave me all these blankets that I actually threw away like 2 years ago. Yeah. But that the black British identity has very much been like, okay, we're British, but oh, we're not really from here. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there is this struggle that I have. But I've kind of made a home. There's that idea of nation within a nation. So the black British identity, I think, is forming that hub now, where I feel like the black American experience, that's been going on for so long. That's been formed and it's really solidified. Like when I went to New Orleans, I was like, whoa. But the black British one is growing. Yeah,
Kinde makes a good point in the book. So we're just speaking around you.
I know, it's like, okay, what do you think?
Yeah, because you make a good point about why it's been there for so long, right?
Yeah, and I think also one of the points I make is that it's a problem.
Yeah. Actually.
So that formation of black Britishness as an identity, which is happening, you see a lot in it. That whole thing on BBC about black and British and trying to prove we were here in the Tudor time and all that. You know, it's this idea that we belong here, for me, is hugely problematic. I never say black British. I just say I'm black and I'm in Britain.
Yeah.
And that's as much as I can.
I like that. I'm black in Britain.
I'm black and I'm in Britain.
Black in Britain.
Yeah.
I'm B.I.B.
I'm B.I.B., baby.
I like that.
No, because the thing is, like, with America, like, people were transported from Africa to America. Whereas if you're Caribbean, you're kind of like, all of that energy is left in the Caribbean, but then now we're in Britain, if that makes any sense. So then you are fine. Like, so America is going to have a stronger history of these things because they're still there. They will go back to the south and go back to and see plantations where possibly their ancestors were, you know, slaves.
It's
and
mad. Enslaved.
Same with Africa, like people coming from Africa to UK, like they had that direct link back. It's just,
yeah, but that's part of the problem as well, though, is that, you know, Jamaica was part of the Caribbean, was part of the UK in the same way that the north and the south are part of the same country.
Yeah.
My dad came in 60, I think it was.
Yeah.
He had a British passport.
Yeah.
Like, it very much is. Caribbean is the British south. We just don't talk about it like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we kind of see ourselves as these voluntary migrants. Well, it's nonsense. No. Nothing voluntary about any of it.
Yeah.
Right. And that also plays, that's also a problem that we should kind of.
Yeah. So how did you feel about the whole Windrush scandal situation that was going on? Because there was this huge discussion on it in my family anyway. It was like, oh, we were invited here. We built the country. Like this and the other. We didn't come over looking for anything, blah, 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 blah. How do you feel?
How would you expect? I was surprised. Everybody's so surprised. Mm-hmm. Like, because that generation particularly had this kind of, you know, with British, because they had, you want to find a really, really pro royalist, go find an old Jamaican. They love the Queen, man. Love. Mm.
And they're my nan was watching every wedding and yes, had every dish.
Pictures of Diana.
Yeah, pictures of Diana. They all loved that. Everyone loved Diana, though. You can't even be.
Yeah, lucky I kind of got that.
I was young, but I still loved Diana.
Yeah, I was literally like, I love Diana. Yeah. Why? I don't know.
But so yeah, people came expecting good treatment and got really bad treatment. And I don't know what we're still expecting good treatment. Yeah. 50 years later, because it's obvious that we never came as citizens.
Yeah.
We came as subjects, and we've been treated as subjects, whether we're born here, whether we're born in the Caribbean. So for me, it was just a perfect example of what it is. Yeah. In fact, it couldn't have come at a better time, because otherwise we would have had this huge celebration of Windrush, and isn't it great, and blah blah blah. But actually, this is how we should remember Windrush.
Yeah.
And it's a bad thing to happen, but the timing of it was actually perfect.
Yeah,
they were forced to, but then you think about it, like, I think, did you watch Small Island?
Yeah.
When it came on, and like, I watch that every so often because it just gives me this, like, you do kind of hold your breath. I hold my breath a lot watching it, because I'm just like, they're all, you know, they're all educated, they're all getting their qualifications, they are very, very uppity, but they're very like, they are though, like, you know, there's this, well, Jamaicans are proud anyway, so they're going to be very like the astute, but then it's like, as soon as they got to the UK, and like, they were so happy and so willing to leave the country, flying the Union Jack, all these different things, and then they were in the UK, and then they were really like, they eat fish and chips out of newspaper.
Yeah, try hard to find jobs.
Like, you know, they get laughed out of institutions because their qualifications aren't.
Walks into a broom room.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and she just kept, you know, she kept it, but they had to laugh about it. But it was just like, you know, watching that.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it. But I don't know. But that's been around for ages, so I don't know why people still.
It happens a lot. Like, even like with Africans traveling here, you leave home and you've got all these qualifications. You come here and they're not accepted. You now have to be a cab driver or, I don't know. You're a doctor, but now you're a nurse. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is it not true that a lot of Africans that came over in the early stages were coming to go to university?
Yeah.
Yeah. That. So there was a lot more of educated kind of thing.
Yeah, because there was a difference.
Yeah.
African and Caribbean migrants is a much bigger difference.
Yeah.
And you can see that in later the playground on. As well. But later on, now it's changed completely. Like,
yeah.
Now it's completely different.
Because I think in the early stages, obviously Stuart Hall came over and he went to university, and various other Jamaicans came over and went to university. But
it's so weird because in universities, I find there's a lot more African
now, yeah,
than there are Caribbean men and women.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that's an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless they have links with the University of West Indies, we're not really going to see them. Because like UCL have links, so you're going to see a lot of them there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
But that's a key way that neocolonialism continues, right? Britain educates the elite of African countries who go back and ruin the countries, right? I mean, you literally get trained how to ruin your country. That's the point.
Because you mentioned that in the book as well. Like, yeah.
I love that. Not really, but yeah.
I always say to international development students, the worst possible subject you could ever teach.
Come
over to get MA in international development. That's literally the MA in how to ruin your country.
Oh,
that's
man.
The point of it. That's the whole degree.
Yeah.
Radicalize it, man. Infiltrate that. Do you have any more questions, Ray?
No, I'm all questioned out because I'm so like depressed.
You're not supposed to be depressed.
We're not doing enough, and everything that we think we're doing is great isn't touching the surface. Like, it's not even pinching the ozone layer of change. It's basically giving us a stage to perform for a bit, make us feel like we're doing a bit, and then packing up the stage and saying go home.
Yeah, so
we're on this stage.
Yeah, I think some of the highlights of the book for me were kind of made me raise questions about reparations, about what that looks like. Also about how do we step outside of this Western idea of economics and what an African economics model would look like. And that was it. Like, and then obviously skin bleaching, people are bleaching out here. they're trying to look whiter. But it's just... Yeah, I mean, guys, get the book. It's like, listen.
How long did it take you to write it, by the way?
Actually, writing it wasn't that long. 9-10 months. Something like that. The last chapter was a day. 5,000 words, one day, just came out.
Yeah.
The best thing I probably ever write.
Yeah.
And it just But it's really years. It's probably like 10 years of research, different stuff.
Yeah, research, different things come to you.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic, guys. That is Back to Black, retelling Black radicalism for the 21st century by Kehinde Andrews.
Go read it.
So mostly flicks this week. Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood. I was actually so shocked when you said that.
Never heard of that film until this morning.
Like, I hadn't watched that film in ages. And I was like, nah, this is actually too funny that you'd actually pick this film. So, do you want to explain what the film is about?
Yeah, so Don't Be a Menace, it's a Wayans Brothers spoof, basically. So it spoofs the old, like, hood movies. Menace to Society, Boys in the Hood, South Central. And it just does it. I picked it because it does it so well. And it kind of picks up some of the themes of the book as well. You've got your fake African nationalist, you've got racism, you've got the police, when so, he wants to be white.
Really. Yeah, hates himself.
You got all of it. It's great. And yeah. I want to do a series of film showings. So we show the hood movies, and then we show and have a discussion.
Yeah. So. I think that'd be good. That'd be very good. I want to come to that. Invite me. But I feel like
that'd be good to go. Just
you know what? Yeah, because that is actually really interesting. Because I was watching it, as I was kind of reading this alongside it, I was like, so because you mentioned ghettos in the book.
The film, they made it look really pretty. Like, the street was nice, obviously inside, but like the homes were like, they were much prettier than our estates. Do you know what I mean?
That's what the hood looks. Well, I don't know. I've never been to the hood, so I don't know.
Well, it's LA. LA's got more space. So yeah. They do have more space.
Yeah.
And it does look a bit light. So if you watch, it's kind of muddled very much on Boys in the Hood.
Boys in the Hood, yeah.
They had the similar streets. But every so often in the film, there's Keenan Ivory Wayans will shout, message.
Yeah, the postman.
Yeah, the postman. Like, and he'll be like, and he'll kind of make sort of like, it will get really deep for like a little bit, and then it will show you like the nonsense that comes with all of these films. And I feel like I used to really hate the Wayans Brothers films just because I was like, you know, this is such a prominent black family. This is a family of entertainers. This is a family of comedians. This is a family that have never won an Oscar or never been in anything that is of some like.
Of Western white value.
Western white value, but like they are very well trained, good actors. And I feel like what they could build as a black family.
What can they build in the eyes of who? Because some people think, they themselves think that they're successful because they do a certain type of film. But if you want them to do a sort of Oscar bait
I really hate it when we just reduce to comedy. Do you know what I mean? When we just reduced to being...
But that deepness that you're talking about, where is that coming from? Do you know what I mean? You want it to be all like hard-hitting, but...
I want them to be in hard-hitting films. I want them to be...
They do hard-hitting films, but it's normally...
They're only ever comedic value in films. This is what I mean. All of them. Every single one of them. Damon Wayans is in, I forgot what it's called, it's in some police show at the moment. And... I'm watching it and I was like, everything that you're saying is for comedic effect. Like, I know that you are a comedian by nature, that makes some, like, obviously, but it's just like everything you're saying is about comedy. Everything they are in is a comedy. And I just felt like, you know, where is the,
you know, that's why I like this film, Don't Be a Menace, because it is a comedy and it's funny. Well, you know, it plays on things like Afrocentrism and a guy has a white, he's really African, but he has a white partner.
The
scene with Bernie Mac, the late Bernie Mac, where he's a police officer and he pulls over and he hates black people and stuff. It's funny, but it is telling you, it is also political.
It's a hyper intense. But then is it a critique on the hood films? It's a critique, isn't it? Like, they're not... Because that's what is it when his mum drops Trey off and she's like, "Am I going to see you later?" And she's like, "He's like, you know, honey,
you don't see
you never see positive black
positive females." And I wish that I was like,
wasn't Vivica Fox?
She was amazing. I was
cracking up because I was like, "Well, actually, in the film, Boys in the Hood, we never saw the mum again. Like, well, literally, we saw her for a little bit, like every so often to administer discipline or, you know what I mean. But we never saw her again.
When you do see them, they're probably like." The romantic subject, and they're not really...
in those films they're usually with the curlers and shouting at their sons or something like, you damn
get the fuck out of here.
Like, this dumb
the grandmother just wow, I remember just this woman was ready to fight.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
That's just what I mean about the Wayans films. Like they do all of that Scary Movie 1 and 2.
Also, why does the guy have a condom in his head? He had weed. I was like, this is hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
Marlon. Marlon Wayans. But like, it's the same thing with Scary Movie 1 and 2, that the Wayans kind of like,
yeah,
they did the exact same thing.
And Regina
Hall, isn't it?
Hall, yeah, wasn't it? She was
but
amazing.
They did the exact same thing. It's like, you know, overdo the fight scenes, overdo the slapstick comedy of it. It just became...
I don't know. I think the critique of...
The hood,
but like also because my concern was, we're laughing about this as black people and we've watched these films and we're laughing about them. Now, if we're looking at the white gaze and how if you get like a white person to... Like if I saw a white person watching this film and they're cracking up, I'd be so offended.
Yeah.
I'd be like, why are you laughing? Do you know what I mean? Mm. And I was like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that.
That is true. It's a bit like one of Chris Rock's funniest... I love Chris Rock. Like one of his funniest skits is Black People versus Niggas.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. Yeah, he never did it again because white people loved it, right? They laughed at all the nigger jokes.
Yeah. Mm.
And there are a lot of nigger jokes in...
Yeah.
Don't be a menace.
Yeah.
But it's for us, isn't it? So.
Yeah.
Who's it for? It's for us, right? We can't watch it. We can enjoy it.
What do you think of... All right, so we're talking about radicalism, right? So these black filmmakers, so we've got... When like the older few, like in the same vein, like Tyler Perry's, for example. What do we think about that? What do we think about what he's doing? Because you think about, on one hand, you're like, yeah, he's creating employment for these black actors who won't necessarily get cast in anything.
Yeah.
And he's doing that. Same with the Wayans.
Yeah.
I don't know who else is out there. There's many. I mean, of late, as the quality has improved, we see Ava DuVernay. We see
quality has improved because we're nearing onto white films.
No, it's not even.
What are we doing?
Just better writing by Ava DuVernay. Like, you know what I mean?
Okay.
What's the guy who did Black Panther?
Ryan Coogler.
Ryan Coogler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just seeing the change. Yeah. But like for so long, it was Tyler Perry.
Yeah, I mean Tyler Perry is more power, just not black power. I think that's the it's not, and it has been that kind of buffoonery. And do you want to get people jobs and stuff?
Yeah,
it's changing now and it's getting better. But even though they're serious, some of these films still have the same problem.
Yeah,
precisely.
In some ways, but like Black Panther. Don't get me started on Black Panther because I was going to pick Black Panther.
Wait.
Oh, we could talk about
Beyonce was too much. For
well, let's talk about Wakanda then, shall we?
Wait a minute.
That should have been a chat.
I know.
Let's talk about Wakanda.
Let's talk about Wakanda.
Wakanda never ever. Wakanda, that's the main problem with the film.
Yeah.
Actually, the idea of Wakanda is so problematic and racist. This is that you would have a place in Africa that has all the resources that could have stopped slavery, colonialism, poverty.
But did
and we'll just go, meh. You know, the migrants, the border.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And that, for me, that just messed up the whole film.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you don't have to be so deep with it. You know, just watch it for like entertainment value.
Yeah, no,
you know? No, I get it.
And the women as well, the role of women. Like, on the surface, it was great, but really look at the narrative. It's terrible. It was the fact that the Killmonger can come off the street, fight T'Challa, and take over, and everybody goes, oh, yeah, fair enough. I mean, that's so crazy. That's that undermines everything it did positively for women in the movie.
But wasn't that more to do with the way that culture and tradition?
Because you have to fight him, and then he becomes king in it.
And he's of noble blood, so he managed to.
I don't like that idea of noble blood anyway.
But it's so patriarchal, really. Yeah, so what you're actually saying is the whole thing is really patriarchal because it comes down to two men fighting. Even when he loses, where do they go? The women who want to change it, they go to find a bigger black man to fight for them.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you think about it, it's crazy.
But it makes sense. Do you know why it makes sense? Because always deal with the black issue first before people deal with the black issue first before they deal with the women issue.
Yeah.
So this, like, Black Panther, Wakanda tried to tackle blackness.
Mm-hmm.
It did not tackle women. Or tried to.
Didn't it? I think it did.
No, I tried to. Right? I think it just said, you can be a warrior, you can make technology, but you can't be queen, or you can't, do you know what I mean? Oh, I'm in love with you. Be my wife. Okay, but I'll be here, Nakia.
I find it quite powerful that Wakabi actually knelt down to Okoye. in battle, and I felt that really strange. I felt like that was really powerful in its sense. But I guess I see what you guys are saying.
But it wasn't for her; it was for Wakanda.
I mean, come on, in real life, the women would have just killed Killmonger,
right?
Throwing him out. This
is true, you know. But we wouldn't have a film again, then. So sometimes I have to take it when we, you know, we can get it. That was a great discussion. I like that.
Anyway, so where can people find you, Kehinde?
Harambe organisation of Black Unity, which is blackunity.org.uk, which really the book is kind of, this is the organisation. It's not just theory. Yeah. We've tried to start the organisation. So you can find out some of the stuff we're doing there. Also, I'm on Twitter. It's at Kehinde, K-E-H-I-N-D-E _ Andrews. Mm-hmm. And I think Instagram's the same, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Kill. Do we have any announcements for this week? Oh, we are going to be at Cheltenham, so please...
Whoop. Guys, so we're going to be at Cheltenham Lit Festival, and we're going to be talking about a book. We don't know yet what it is.
Yeah, we're going to be doing that.
Something radical, I hope.
Just check out mostly-lit.com, and we've got a few events coming up, and we've got a few things to announce soon, so stay tuned.
Thank you so much for listening once again. Yeah. You can catch us at Mostly Lit on Twitter, Mostly Lit Pod on Instagram, and email us at mostlylit@gmail.com.
Yes.
I got it right
this time. Thank you. And you hit us up where you want to hit us up. And
make sure you go and read Back to Black.
Yeah, drop us an email with any thoughts that you have. All right, guys.
Catch you next week. Bye.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Ray.
I'm Alex Reed.
Welcome back to another episode of
Mostly Lit.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.